Susan recognized the country of Lanker from the air, a little bowl of woods and fields, perched like a nest on the edge of the Ramtop Mountains. And she found the cottage, too, which was not the corkscrew-chimneyed compost-heap kind of witch's house popularized by grim fairy tales and other books, but a spanking new one, with gleaming thatch and a manicured front lawn. There were more ornaments—gnomes, toadstools, pink bunnies, big-eyed deer, around a tiny pond, than any sensible gardener should have allowed. Susan spotted one brightly painted gnome fishing. No, that wasn't a rod he was holding, was it? Oh, surely a nice old lady wouldn't put something like that in her garden, would she? Would she? Susan was bright enough to go around to the back, because witches were allergic to front doors. It was opened by a small, fat, rosy-cheeked woman, whose little currant eyes said, "Yep, that's my gnome, all right, and be thankful he's only whittling in the pond." Mrs. Ogg, the midwife. There was a pause before Mrs. Ogg said, "The very same." "You don't know me, but," said Susan, and realized that Mrs. Ogg was looking past her at Binky, who was standing by the gate. The woman was a witch, after all. "Maybe I do know you," said Mrs. Ogg. "Of course, if you just stole that horse, you just don't know how much trouble you are in." "I borrowed it. The owner is my grandfather." Another pause, and it was disconcerting how those friendly little eyes could bore into yours like an auger.
"You'd better come in," said Mrs. Ogg.
The inside of the cottage was as clean and new as the outside. Things gleamed, and there were a lot of them to gleam. The place was a shrine to bad but enthusiastically painted china ornaments, which occupied every flat surface. What space was left was full of framed pictures. Two harassed-looking women were polishing and dusting.
"I got company," said Mrs. Ogg sternly,
and the women left with such alacrity that the word fled might have been appropriate.
"My daughters-in-law," said Mrs. Ogg,
sitting down in a plump armchair which, over the years, had shaped itself to fit her.
"They like to help a poor old lady who's all alone in the world."
Susan took in the pictures. If they were all of family members, Mrs. Ogg was head of an army. Mrs. Ogg, unashamedly caught out in a flagrant lie, went on,
"Sit down, girl, and say what's on your mind. There's tea brewing."
"I need to know something."
"Most people do," said Mrs. Ogg, "and they can go on wantin'."
"I want to know about a birth," said Susan, persevering.
"Oh, yes? Well, I've done hundreds of confinements. Thousands, probably."
"I imagine this one was difficult."
"A lot of them are," said Mrs. Ogg.
"Oh, you'd remember this one. I don't know how it started, but I'd imagine that a stranger came knocking."
"Oh?"
Mrs. Ogg's face became a wall. The black eyes stared out at Susan as if she was an invading army. "You're not helping me, Mrs. Ogg."
"That's right. I ain't," said Mrs. Ogg. "I think I know about you, miss, but I don't care who you are, you see. You can go and get the other one, if you like. Don't think I ain't seen him, neither. I've been at plenty of deathbeds, too. But deathbeds is public, mostly, and birthbeds ain't, not if the lady don't want them to be. So you get the other one, and I'll spit in his eye."
"This is very important, Mrs. Ogg."
"You're right there,"
said Mrs. Ogg firmly. "I can't say how long ago it was. It may have been last week, even. Time, that's the key." And there it was. Mrs. Ogg was not a poker player, at least against someone like Susan. There was the tiniest flicker of the eyes. Mrs. Ogg's chair was rammed back in her effort to rise, but Susan got to the mantelpiece first. and snatched what was there, hidden in plain view among the ornaments.
"You give that here!"
shouted Mrs. Ogg, as Susan held it out of her reach. She could feel the power in the thing. It seemed to pulse in her hand. "Have you any idea what this is, Mrs. Ogg?" she said, opening her hand to reveal the little glass bulbs.
"Yes, it's an egg timer that don't work."
Mrs. Ogg sat down hard in her overstuffed chair, so that her little legs rose off the floor for a moment. "It looks to me like a day, Mrs. Ogg, a day's worth of time." Mrs. Ogg glanced at Susan, and then at the little hourglass in her hand.
"I reckon there was something odd about it," she said. "The sand don't go through when you tip it up, see?"
"That's because you don't need it to yet, Mrs. Ogg." Nanny Ogg appeared to relax. Once again, Susan reminded herself that she was dealing with a witch. They tended to keep up.
"I kept it 'cause it was a gift," said the old lady. "And it looks so pretty, too. What do them letters round the edge say?"
Susan read the words etched on the metal base of the lifetimer. "Tempus redux." "Time returned," she said.
"Ah, that'd be it," said Mrs. Ogg. "The man did say I'd be repaid for my time."
"The man?" said Susan gently. Nanny Ogg glanced up, her eyes ablaze.
"Don't you try to take advantage of me just 'cause I'm momentary a bit flustered," she snapped. "There's no way around Nanny Ogg."
Susan looked at the woman, and this time not with the lazy eye. And there was, indeed, no way around Mrs. Ogg. But there was another way with Mrs. Ogg. It went straight through the heart. "A child needs to know his parents, Mrs. Ogg," she said, "now more than ever. He needs to know who he really is. It's going to be hard for him, and I want to help him."
"Why?"
"Because I wish someone had helped me," said Susan.
"Yes, but there's rules to midwifery," said Nanny Ogg. "You don't say what was said or what you saw. Not if the lady don't want you to."
The witch wriggled awkwardly in her chair, her face going red. "She wants to tell me," Susan knew. "She's desperate to, but I've got to play it right, so she can square it with herself." "I'm not asking for names, Mrs. Ogg, because I expect you don't know them," she went on.
"That's true."
"But the child..."
"Look, miss, I'm not supposed to tell a living soul about..."
"If it helps, I'm not entirely certain that I am one," said Susan. She watched Mrs. Ogg for a while. "But I understand. There have to be rules, don't there? Thank you for your time." Susan stood up and put the preserved day back on the mantelpiece. Then she walked out of the cottage, shutting the door behind her. Binky was still waiting by the gate. She mounted up, and it wasn't until then that she heard the door open behind her.
"That's what he said," said Mrs. Ogg, "when he gave me the egg timer. 'Thank you for your time, Mrs. Ogg,' he said. 'You'd better come back in, my girl.'"
Death found Pestilence in a hospice in the Amedos. Pestilence liked hospitals. There was always something for him to do. Currently, he was trying to remove the "Now wash your hands" sign over a cracked basin. He looked up. "Oh, it's you," he said. "Soap? I'll give 'em soap." "I sent out the call," said Death. "Oh, yes, right, yes," said Pestilence, clearly embarrassed. "You still got your horse?" "Of course, but, you had a fine horse." "Look, Death, it's, look, it's not that I don't see your point, but..." "Excuse me."
Pestilence stepped aside as a white-robed nun, completely oblivious of the two horsemen, passed between them. But he took the opportunity to breathe in her face.
"Just a mild flu," he said, catching Death's expression.
So we can count on you, can we?
To ride out?
Yes.
For the big one?
It's expected of us.
How many of the others have you got?
You are the first. Ah. Death sighed. Of course, there had been plenty of diseases long before humans had been around, but humans had definitely created pestilence. They had a genius for crowding together, for poking around in jungles, for setting the midden so handily next to the well. Pestilence was, therefore, part human, with all that this entailed. He was frightened. I see, Death said.
Oh, the way you put it.
You are afraid?
I'll think about it.
Yes, I am sure you will.
Quite a lot of brandy splashed into Mrs. Ogg's mug. She waved the bottle vaguely at Susan with an inquiring look. No, thank you.
Fair enough, fair enough.
Nanny Ogg put the bottle aside and took a draught of the brandy as though it was beer.
A man came knocking, she said. 3 times he came in my life. Last time was, maybe 10 days ago. Same man every time. He wanted a midwife.
10 days ago, said Susan. But the child's at least 16. She stopped.
Ah, you've got it, said Mrs. Ogg. I could see you was bright. Time didn't matter to him. He wanted the best midwife. And it was like he'd found out about me but got the date wrong, just like you or me could knock on the wrong door. Can you understand what I mean?
More than you think, said Susan.
The 3rd time, another gulp at the brandy, he was in a bit of a state, said Mrs. Ogg. That's how I knew he was just a man, despite everything that happened after. It was because he was panicking, to tell you the truth. Pregnant fathers often panic. He was going on about me coming right away and how there was no time. He had all the time in the world. He just wasn't thinking properly, 'cause husbands never do when the time comes. They panic, 'cause it ain't their world anymore.
And what happened next? Said Susan.
He took me in his, well, it was like one of them old chariots. He took me to...
Mrs. Ogg hesitated.
I've seen a lot of strange things in my life, I'll have you know, she said,
as if preparing the ground for a revelation. I can believe it.
It was a castle made of glass.
Mrs. Ogg gave Susan a look that dared her to disbelieve. Susan decided to hurry things up. Mrs. Ogg, one of my earliest memories is of helping to feed the pale horse. You know, the one outside, the horse of death. His name is Binky. So please don't keep stopping. There is practically no limit to the things I find normal.
There was a woman. Well, eventually there was a woman, said the witch. Can you imagine someone exploding into 1,000,000 pieces? Yes, I expect you can. Well, imagine it happening the other way. There's a mist, and it's all flying together, and then, whoosh, there's a woman. Then, whoosh, back into a mist again. And all the time, this noise.
Mrs. Ogg ran her finger around the edge of the brandy glass, making it hum. A woman kept incarnating and then disappearing again? Why?
Because she was frightened, of course. 1st time, see?
Mrs. Ogg grinned.
I personally never had any problems in that area, but I've been at a lot of births when it's all new to the girl, and she'll be frightened as hell. And when push comes to shove, if you take my meaning, old midwifery term there, she'll be yelling and swearing at the father, and I reckon she'd give anything to be somewhere else. Well, this lady could be somewhere else, Huh, we'd have been in a real pickle if it wasn't for the man, as it turned out.
The man that brought you?
He was kind of foreign, you know? Like the hub people. Bald as a coot. I remember thinking, you look like a young man, mister, but you look like you've been a young man for a long, long time, if I'm any judge. Well, normally, I wouldn't have any man there. But he sat and talked to her in his foreign lingo, and sang her songs and little poems and soothed her, and back she came, out of thin air. And I was ready, and it was one, two, done. And then she was gone. Except that she was still there, I think. In the air.
What did she look like? Said Susan.
Mrs. Ogg gave her a look. You've got to remember the view I got where I was sitting, she said. The kind of description I might give you ain't a thing anyone to put on a poster, if you get my meaning. And no woman looks at her best at a time like that. She was young. She had dark hair.
Mrs. Ogg refilled her brandy glass, and this meant the pause went on for some time.
And she was old, too, if you're after the truth of it. Not old like me. I mean, old.
She stared at the fire.
Old, like darkness and stars.
She said to the flames. The boy was left outside the Thieves' Guild, said Susan, to break the silence. I suppose they thought that with gifts like that he'd be all right.
He? Said Mrs. Ogg. Why he? Why are you talking about he?
Lady Lejeune was being strong. She'd never realized how much humans were controlled by their bodies. The thing nagged day and night. It was always too hot, too cold, too empty, too full, too tired. The key was discipline, she was sure. Auditors were immortal. If she couldn't tell her body what to do, she didn't deserve to have one. Bodies were a major human weakness. Senses, too. The auditors had hundreds of senses, since every possible phenomenon had to be witnessed and recorded. She could only find 5 available now. 5 ought to be easy to deal with. But they were wired directly into the rest of the body. They didn't just submit information, they made demands. She'd walked past a stall selling roasted meats, and her mouth had started to drool. The sense of smell wanted the body to eat without consulting the brain. But that wasn't the worst part. The brain itself did its own thinking. That was the hardest part. The bag of soggy tissue behind the eyes worked away independently of its owner. It took in information from the senses and checked them against memory and presented options. Sometimes the hidden parts of it even fought for control of the mouth. Humans weren't individuals. They were, each one, a committee. Some of the other members of the committee were dark and red and entirely uncivilized. They had joined the brain before civilization. Some of them had got aboard even before humanity. And the bit that did the joined-up thinking had to fight in the darkness of the brain to get the casting vote. After a little more than a couple of weeks as a human, the entity that was Lady Lejeune was having real trouble. Food, for example. Auditors did not eat. They recognized that feeble life forms had to consume one another to obtain energy and bodybuilding material. The process was astonishingly inefficient, however, and her ladyship had tried assembling nutrients directly out of the air. This worked, but the process felt... what was the word? Oh, yes. Creepy. Besides, part of the brain didn't believe it was getting fed and insisted that it was hungry. Its incessant nagging interfered with her thought processes, and so, despite everything, she'd had to face up to the whole, well, the whole orifices business. The auditors had known about these for a long time. The human body appeared to have up to 8 of them. One didn't seem to work, and the rest appeared to be multifunctional, although surprisingly there seemed to be only one thing that could be done by the ears. So yesterday, she'd tried a piece of dry toast. It had been the single worst experience of her existence. It had been the single most intense experience of her existence. It had been something else, too. As far as she could understand the language, it had been enjoyable. It seemed that the human sense of taste was quite different to the sense employed by an auditor. That was precise, measured, analytical. But the human sense of taste was like being hit in the mouth by the whole world. It had been half an hour of watching fireworks in her head before she remembered to swallow. How did humans survive this? She'd been fascinated by the art galleries. It was clear that some humans could present reality in a way that made it even more real, that spoke to the viewer, that seared the mind. But what could possibly transcend the knowledge that the genius of an artist had to poke alien substances into his face? Could it be that humans had got used to it? And that was only the start. The sooner the clock was finished, the better. A species as crazy as this couldn't be allowed to survive. She was visiting the clockmaker and his ugly assistant every day now, giving them as much help as she dared, but they always seemed one vital step away from completion. Amazing! She could even lie to herself, because another voice in her head, which was part of the dark committee, said, "You're not helping, are you? You're stealing parts and twisting parts, and you go back every day because of the way he looks at you, don't you?" Parts of the internal committee that were so old they didn't have voices, only direct control of the body, tried to interfere at this point, and she tried to put them out of her mind. And now she had to face the other auditors. They would be punctual. She pulled herself together. Water had taken to running out of her eyes lately for no reason at all. She did the best she could with her hair and made her way to the large drawing room. Grayness was up, blinked, and opened their eyes. Three of the figures were male, three were female. They were dressed in human-sized equivalents of the auditor's robes. The remaining auditors drew back, but one said, "They will accompany you to the clockmaker, and matters will be resolved today. They will not eat or breathe." "Ha!" thought one of the little voices that made up Lady Lejeune's thinking. One of the figures whimpered. "The body will breathe," said her ladyship. "You will not persuade it that air is not required." She was aware of the choking noises. "You are thinking, yes, we can exchange necessary materials with the outside world, and this is true," she went on. "But the body does not know that. It thinks it is dying. Let it breathe." There was a series of gasps. "And you will feel better shortly," said her ladyship, and was enthralled to hear the inner voice think, "These are your jailers, and you are already stronger than them." One of the figures felt its face with a clumsy hand, and panting said, "Whom do you speak to with your mouth?" "You," said Lady Lejeune. "Us?" This will take some explaining. "No," said the auditor. "Danger lies that way. We believe the body imposes a method of thought on the brain. No blame attaches. It is a malfunction. We will accompany you to the clockmaker. We will do this now." "Not in those clothes," said Lady Lejeune. "You will frighten him. It may lead to irrational actions." There was a moment of silence. The auditors made flesh looked hopelessly at one another. "You have to talk with your mouth," Lady Lejeune prompted. "The minds stay inside the head." One said, "What is wrong with these clothes? It is a simple shape found in many human cultures." Lady Lejeune walked to the window. "You see the people down there," she said. "You must dress in appropriate city fashions." Reluctantly, the auditors did so. And while they retained the grayness, they did give themselves clothes that would pass unnoticed in the street. Up to a point, anyway. "Only those of female appearance should wear dresses," Lady Lejeune pointed out. A hovering gray shape said, "Warning. Danger. The one calling itself Lady Lejeune may give unsafe advice. Warning. Understood, said one of the incarnate ones. We know the way. We will lead. It walked into the door. The auditors clustered around the door for a while, and then one of them glared at Lady Lejeune, who smiled. Doorknob, she said. The auditor turned back to the door, stared at the brass knob, and then looked the door up and down. It dissolved into dust.
Doorknob was simpler, said Lady Lejeune.
There were big mountains around the hub, but the ones towering above the temple didn't all have names, because there was simply too many of them. Only gods have enough time to name all the pebbles on a beach, but gods don't have the patience. Copperhead was small enough to be big enough to have a name. Lobsang awoke and saw its crooked peak, towering above the lesser local mountains outlined against the sunrise. Sometimes the gods have no taste at all. They allow sunrises and sunsets in ridiculous pink and blue hues that any professional artist would dismiss as the work of some enthusiastic amateur who'd never looked at a real sunset. This was one of those sunrises. It was a kind of sunrise a man rises and looks at and says, "No real sunrise could paint the sky surgical appliance pink." Nevertheless, it was beautiful.
But not tasteful.
He was half covered in a pile of dry bracken. There was no sign of the Yeti. It was springtime here. There was still snow, but there was the occasional patch of bare soil and a hint of green. Lobsang stared around and saw leaves in bud. Lutzer was standing some way off, staring up into a tree. He didn't turn his head as Lobsang approached. Where's the Yeti?
He wouldn't go further than this. Can't ask a Yeti to leave snow, whispered Lutzer.
Oh, whispered Lobsang.
Why are we whispering? Look at the bird.
It was perched on a branch by a fork in the tree, next to what looked like a birdhouse, and nibbling at a piece of roughly round wood it held in one claw.
Must be an old nest they're repairing, said Lutzer. Can't have got that advanced this early in the season.
Looks like some kind of an old box to me, said Lobsang.
He squinted to see better.
Is it an old clock? He added.
Look at what the bird is nibbling, suggested Lutzer.
Well, it looks like a crude gear wheel, but why?
Well spotted. That lad is a clock cuckoo. A young one, by the look of it, trying to build a nest that'll attract a mate. Not much chance of that, see? It's got the numerals all wrong, and it's stuck the hands on crooked.
A bird that builds clocks?
I thought a cuckoo clock was a clock with a mechanical cuckoo, which came out when... And where do you think people got such a strange idea from?
That's some kind of miracle.
Why, said Lutzer, they barely go for more than half an hour. They keep lousy time, and the poor dumb males go frantic trying to get them wound. But even to...
Everything happens somewhere, I suppose, said Lutzer.
Not worth making too much of a fuss. Got any food left?
No, we finished it last night, said Lobsang. He added, hopefully,
I heard tell that really advanced monks can live on the, life force in the actual air itself.
Only on the planet Sausage, I expect, said Lutzer.
No, we'll skirt Copperhead and find something in the valleys on the other side. Let's go. There's not much time.
But time enough to watch a bird, thought Lobsang, as he let the world around him become blue and fade, and the thought was comforting. It was easier going without the snow on the ground, provided he avoided the strange resistance offered by bushes and long grass. Lutzer walked on ahead, looking oddly colourful and unreal against the faded landscape. They went past the entrance to dwarf mines, but saw no one above ground. Lobsang was glad of that. The statues that he had seen in the villages yesterday weren't dead, he knew, but merely frozen at a different speed of time. Lutzer had forbidden him to go near anyone, but he needn't have bothered. Walking around the living statues was invasive, somehow. It made it worse when you realized that they were moving, but very, very slowly. The sun had barely moved from the horizon when they came down through warmer woods on the rim side of the mountain. Here the landscape had a more domesticated air.
It was woodland rather than forest. The game trail they'd been following crossed a creek at a point where there were cart tracks, old but still not overgrown. Lobsang looked behind him after he'd walked across the ford and watched the water very slowly reclaim the shape of his footprints in the stream. He'd been trained in time-slicing on the snowfields above the valley like the rest of the novices. That was so they couldn't come to any harm, the monks had said, although no one actually explained what harm they might come to. Outside the monastery, this was the first time Lobsang had sliced in a living landscape. It was marvellous. Birds hung in the sky. Early morning bumblebees hovered over the opening flowers. The world was a crystal made of living things. Lobsang slowed near a group of deer cropping the grass and watched as the nearest eye of one of them swiveled with geological slowness to watch him. He saw the skin move as the muscles underneath started to bunch for flight. "Time for a smoko," said Lutzer. The world around Lobsang speeded up. The deer fled along with the magic of the moment. "What's a smoko?" said Lobsang. He was annoyed. The quiet, slow world had been fun. "You ever been to Forex?" "No. There's a barman at the bunch of grapes from there, though." Lutzer lit one of his skinny cigarettes. "Don't mean much," he said. "The barman everywhere is from there. Strange country. Big time source right in the middle. Very useful. Time and space all tangled up. Probably all that beer. Nice place, though. Now, you see that country down there?" On one side of the clearing, the ground fell away steeply, showing treetops and beyond a small patchwork of fields tucked into a fold in the mountains. In the distance was a gorge, and Lobsang thought he could make out a bridge across it. "Doesn't look much like a country," he said. "Looks more like a shelf." "That's which country?" said Lutzer, "and we're going to borrow a broomstick. Quickest way to Ankh-Morpork Park. Only way to travel."
"Isn't that, interfering with history? I mean, I was told that sort of thing is all right up in the valleys, but down here in the world..."
"No, it's absolutely forbidden," said Lutzer, "'cause it's interfering with history. Got to be careful if you're a witch, of course. Some of them are pretty canny."
He caught Lobsang's expression.
"Look, that's why there's rules, understand? So that you think before you break them."
"But..."
Lutzer sighed and pinched out the end of his cigarette.
"We're being watched," he said.
Lobsang spun around. There were only trees and insects buzzing in the early morning air.
"Up there," said Lutzer.
There was a raven perched on the broken crown of a pine tree, shattered in some winter storm. It looked at them, looking at it.
"Caw," it said.
"Oh, it's just a raven," said Lobsang. "There's lots of them in the valley."
"It was watching us when we stopped for tea. There's ravens all over the mountain, Sweeper. And when we met the Yeti," Lutzer persisted. "Well, that settles it, then. It's coincidence. One raven couldn't move that fast." "Well, maybe it's a special raven," said Lutzer. "Anyway, it's not one of our mountain ravens. It's a lowland raven. Mountain ravens croak, they don't caw. Why is it so interested in us?"
"It's a bit
weird, thinking you're being followed by a bird," said Lobsang.
"When you get to my age, you notice things in the sky," said Lutzer. He shrugged and gave a grin.
"You start worrying they might be vultures."
They faded into time and vanished. The raven ruffled its feathers.
"Croak?"
it said.
"Damn."
Lobsang felt around under the thatched eaves of the cottage, and his hand closed on the bristles of a broomstick that had been thrust among the reeds.
"This is rather like stealing," he said,
as Lutzer helped him down.
"No, it's not,"
said the sweeper, taking the broomstick and holding it up so that he could look along its length.
"And I'll tell you why. If we sort things out, we'll drop it off on our way back, and she'll never know it's gone. And if we don't sort things out, well, she'll still never know it's gone. Honestly, they don't take much care of their sticks, witches. Look at the bristles on this one. I wouldn't use it to clean a pond. Oh, well, back into clock time, lad. I'd hate to fly on one of these things while I was slicing."
He straddled the stick and gripped the handle. It rose a little way.
"Good suspension, at least," he said.
You can have the comfy seat on the back. Hold tight to my own room, and make sure you wrap your robe around you. These things are pretty breezy.
Lobsang pulled himself aboard, and the stick rose. As it drew level with the lower branches around the clearing, it brought Lutzer to eye level with a raven. It shifted uneasily, and turned its head this way and that, trying to fix both eyes on him.
"Are you going to caw or croak, I wonder?" said Lutzer, apparently to himself.
"Caw,"
said the raven. "Ah, so you're not the raven we saw on the other side of the mountain, then?"
"Me? Gosh, no," said the raven. "That's croaking territory over there."
"Just checking."
The broom rose higher and set off above the trees in a hubward direction. The raven ruffled his feathers and blinked.
"Damn," he said.
He shuffled around the tree to where the death of rats was sitting.
"Squeak?"
"Look, if you want me to do this undercover work, you've got to get me a book on ornithology, okay?" said Quoth. "Let's go, or I'll never keep up."
Death found Famine in a restaurant in Genua. He had a booth all to himself and was eating duck and dirty rice.
"Oh," said Famine, "it's you."
"Yes, we must ride. You must have got my message."
"Pull up a chair," Famine hissed. "They do a very good maligator sausage here."
"I said we must ride."
"Why?"
Death sat down and explained. Famine listened, although he never stopped eating.
"I see," he said at last. "Thank you, but I think I shall sit this one out."
"Sit it out? You're a horseman."
"Yes, of course. But what is my role here?"
"I beg your pardon."
"No famine appears to be involved, does it? A shortage of food, per se, as such?"
"Well, no, not as such, obviously, but..."
"So, I would, as it were, be turning up just to wave. No, thank you."
"You used to ride out every time," said Death accusingly. Famine waved a bone, airily.
"We had proper apocalypses in those days," he said, and sucked at the bone. "You could sink your teeth into them."
"Nevertheless, this is the end of the world." Famine pushed his plate aside and opened the menu.
"There are other worlds," he said. "Here, too, sentimental, Death. I've always said so."
Death drew himself up. Humans had created famine, too. Oh, there had always been droughts and locusts. But for a really good famine, for fertile land to be turned into a dust bowl by stupidity and avarice, oh, you needed humans. Famine was arrogant. "I am sorry," Death said, "to have trespassed on your time." He went outside, into the crowded street, all alone.
End of side 9.